Welcome to Harder to Kill Radio, a top-rated health and fitness podcast. On this week's episode, I'm joined by Gretchen Rubin, New York Times best-selling author of The Happiness Project, Happier at Home, and Better Than Before. We're talking all about the connection between habit change and happiness, the crucial questions she answered about habits that could make all the difference for you, and some hugely insightful answers to really meaty listener questions. Okay, let's do this. Hey there, and welcome to episode number 29. I'm your host, Steph Godreau. Thank you so much for tuning in to Harder to Kill Radio today and spending a little bit of time with me and my incredibly special guest, Gretchen Rubin. My goal on Harder to Kill Radio is to find the most fascinating people in the world, thought leaders who are dedicating their lives to building unbreakable humans through fitness, nutrition, and mindset. And then, of course, to share their expertise with you so you can apply it to your life. Be sure to visit stupideasypaleo.com/29 to get the show notes from this episode and links to everything that Gretchen and I mentioned. Okay, it's time to jump in. Welcome back to Harder to Kill Radio. Wow, I am so excited to have today's guest on the show because this lady has completely changed the way I look at a lot of things in my life when it comes to the topic of happiness and habit change. And I am so, so, so pleased and a little fangirly right now because I have the wonderful Ms. Gretchen Rubin here on the show with me today. So welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be talking to you.
So in case some of our listeners out there have never heard of you, which I can't imagine if that's even possible, but just to fill people in, you are the number one best-selling author, New York Times bestseller of three amazing books, and more than that, but including the topics of happiness and habit change, The Happiness Project, Happier at Home, and the most recently published book, which is Better Than Before.
Yep.
So, yeah, yep. just a few important titles that people have probably seen in bookstores and on people's coffee tables at their homes and stuff like that. So I'm really excited because I've got a couple questions to ask you. And then I've also got some reader questions. I asked on social media, if you were going to ask a question of a happiness expert, what would it be? And people were pouring their questions out. So I've got a few of those that I selected and we'll definitely toss some of those your way. Some really good ones, actually.
Excellent.
So a lot of people know you from, obviously, your books about happiness and habit change. But if we could kind of fill people in on a little bit on your story, you didn't just start out life as an author thinking, I'm going to write these amazing books and have such an impact on folks. And you were working in the law field under Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. So how in the world did you decide one day that you were going to make the switch from law to writing? And were you scared about that?
It was sort of a gradual process. I went to law school for all the wrong reasons. I'm good at research and writing. It'll keep my options open. It's a great education. I never really thought very much about whether I wanted to be a lawyer. And so, but I had an amazing experience in law. And like, as you said, I went to Yale Law School. I was editor-in-chief of the Law Journal. I was clerking for Sandra Day O'Connor. And, one day I was looking up at the Capitol Dome against the sky and I thought, well, what am I interested in that everybody else in the world is interested in? And I thought, well, power, money, fame, sex. And that those kind of four ideas hit me. It hit me like a lightning bolt. Like this was a big idea.
Yeah.
And I went off and started researching. And this is something that happens to me fairly frequently. I will become obsessed with something and kind of do a ton of research. But in this case, I was just doing more and more and more and more research and amassing this giant trove of notes. And it began to dawn on me that really what I was doing was the kind of thing that a person would do to prepare to write a book. And so I'm sort of mulling that over. And then a couple of other things happened. One is that I went over to the home of a friend who was in education in graduate school. And she had this incredibly boring looking book on her coffee table. And I said, oh, my gosh, is this the kind of stuff you have to read for your program? Uh-huh. And she said, oh, but that's what I read on my own anyway. Mm. And I thought, I want to do for fun and for work the identical things. Like, because I was not doing law for fun on the weekends. Mm-hmm. On the weekends, I was doing this research for this project.
Right.
And I was fortunate because sometimes people know what they want to leave, but they don't know where they want to go. Mm. And I was fortunate because I began to have this idea for a book, and it became more and more clear to me that I really, really did want to try to write it as a professional writer. I wanted to try to get an agent. I wanted to try to get it published. Yeah. And so I knew what I wanted to switch to. And I mean, I went to the bookstore and bought a book that was called something like How to Write and Sell Your Nonfiction Book Proposal, and just did what it said to do. I mean, I had no, and so I did, and sort of step by step, I wrote the proposal. And it was a good time too, because my husband, who I met in law school, was also mm-hmm. switching out of law, and we were both moving from Washington, D.C. to New York City together. Yeah. So it was like a logical time. Like, I was like, I either get a law job now or I try to write a book. And I thought, if I get a law job now, I might never try to write a book.
Yeah.
This is a logical transition. And at that point, I thought, I'd rather fail as a writer than succeed as a lawyer at this point. Right. So I think I need to try to see, try it and either succeed or fail, but at least give it a shot.
So I hear a couple things kind of coming out in that. And one is definitely this idea of like bravery and taking chances. But the other is almost like this innate curiosity that you had. And it almost seems like you continue to have, because if you read kind of the backstory of your books and how you got the ideas for your books, it's mainly you've just been really curious about stuff. Yeah. And I've seen you've called yourself at times a street scientist.
Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate on what that means and how that plays out for you?
Yeah, I'm like a street scientist or an armchair scientist, because I feel like I do my research by just observing what's going on right around me. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I think when you look at what's actually happening around you, you pick up a lot of things that the people who are doing experiments in a laboratory with undergraduates eating marshmallows somehow don't pick up. There's like a lot of advice where I'm like, the only thing about that advice is that advice doesn't seem to work very well. I get why it makes sense on paper, but if you actually talk to people, not so much, and so I really try to pay attention to the patterns that I see around me and to listen really carefully to what people say, because over and over I find that like somebody will say something and it will hit me like, this is really important. Like this, whatever they said, it's like this, there's something significant here. And mm-hmm. it might take me weeks or months to really understand what's going on, like why that seemed important to me. Yeah. But I will become very fixated on something. I recently went through this period of being obsessed with Thomas Merton, who nobody knows who he is anymore. He's kind of like, he was super famous, but now he's lost in the sands of time. Uh-huh. Except to me, like I am, Thomas Merton expert. And, for my own extremely idiosyncratic reasons, but I just couldn't help myself. So I think that, I relentlessly read the research. I love the science. Mm-hmm. I love pop culture. I read a lot of autobiographies and biographies and memoirs to try to understand from people's lives kind of patterns. And then try to put it all together in a way that would be meaningful and accessible to the ordinary person, academics have their own particular concerns, which are extremely valid, but maybe are not so compelling to people who are not in that field. So yeah. I'm really trying to pull out of the research, well, what's the thing that, like, to just an ordinary person in an ordinary day would be of consequence that they would want to try to understand?
And I think that's what you do so well, is bridge that gap between, you kind of go out and do the legwork for people.
Yes.
And say, these are all the amazing things I found, you guys. And now here's the practical implementation of what you can actually do in your life to make some headway with this issue that you might be having.
Oh, well, that's very nice of you to say, because that's definitely definitely what I strive to do, is to make it accessible and interesting. Because I find it also fascinating myself. But you're right. Like, the idea is I'll read all those boring looking books so you don't have to. You know, it's like, yeah.
You can kind of put all the inputs in and like turn some crank somewhere and out pops this amazing, concise, actionable book. Which is super great. So your first two books focused on happiness, your own happiness project, and then kind of the advice around how people can undertake their own happiness project. And then Happier at Home, which is kind of a almost like a follow-up to that. And then with Better Than Before, you took a bit of a departure talking about habit change. So is everybody just happy now? Is that why you changed to habit research and kind of understanding that? Or was it just time to look into something else? Or was it one of those burning questions you just had to answer?
Well, you know, they're very, in my mind, they're very, very closely tied to each other. And sure. And what I began to see is that when I would talk to people about happiness, they would often point to a happiness challenge that they were struggling with. Mm. And over, it was something that had to do with a habit. So somebody would say, well, my problem is that I'm exhausted all the time. Mm. Well, that's about the habit of getting enough sleep. Or somebody would say, my happiness challenge is that I really want to make consistent work on this novel that I'm writing in my free time, and yet I never do it. Well, that's about the habit of being able to write consistently and steadily. Yeah. And so I began to be very interested in the role that habits can play in allowing us to make our lives happier and healthier and more productive. And what I quickly learned is, you know, habits shape about 40% of our everyday life. So if you have habits that work for you, you're much better off than if you have habits that don't work for you. Yeah. And how people can use habits to make themselves happier and healthier and more productive it's interesting because when I look back on the Happiness Project or Happier at Home, it was an idea that was very pervasive, but I hadn't really picked up on it specifically. Mm. But I've been thinking about it kind of indirectly for a long time. And so then when I got to it as a subject, it was sort of like exciting because it fit together with everything I'd been thinking about, but in a way that would seem very fresh and kind of like a bunch of new questions that I hadn't thought about.
So what was the, or was there an aha moment, like the light bulb, lightning bolt from the sky revelation, like, oh my gosh, I figured it out. This is amazing. Mm. I need to share it with people moment when you were writing Better Than Before?
There was a moment where it was like the precursor to that. It was a moment where a friend of mine said something to me where I was really like, I was almost shaking. I'm like, That is the crucial question that I must answer. We were eating lunch, and so I'd been starting to think about habits a lot and how they related to happiness. And we were just talking about it casually. And she said to me, well, here's the thing is I know I would be happier if I exercised. And what's weird is that when I was in high school, I was on the track team. Mm. And I never missed track practice, but I can't go running now. Why? Mm. And I thought, well, why? It's the same person, same behavior. At one time it was effortless. Now she can't do it. Why? And I was like, this is a crucial question. Mm-hmm. I must break this puzzle and understand what is going on here, because that is extremely significant. And what I found in the habit world and in the happiness world too, is that there's this tremendous drive towards the answer. The answer is to do it first thing in the morning. Start small. Do it for 30 days. Give yourself a cheat day. Yeah. Like, that is the answer that's going to work for everybody. But it doesn't. It doesn't work for everybody. And when she told me that, I was like, well, the funny thing is, I can go running now. So what's different about her? What's different about me? What's different from her past than her present? Like, how do we understand ourselves in comparison to each other? What's going on here? And so that was that was the seed of my Four Tendencies framework, which is certainly one of the biggest ideas that was in Better Than Before, or certainly any of my books. It's like the most intellectually challenging thing I've ever come up with. Mm. But when we had that conversation, I immediately had this epiphany that if I could answer that question, I would move forward enormously in my understanding of my subject.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. We were at a conference very recently and, I won't say it was the most earth shattering moment, but it had kind of a moment of revelation. There was a gentleman speaking about personal values and how that affects his business, which is corporate wellness. And it was almost one of those things too, where you're talking about, you know, why is it easy for this person to do this, enact this type of change, and for another person it's so difficult. And the answer kind of all came down to personal values. And that, like, that kind of changed the lens through which I started to look at all these different things, like my coaching practice and what I put on my website and why it's hard for some people to make dietary change and others it's not so hard. And so I definitely know that feeling of like, oh my gosh, this is really, really important. So what came from that then was your four tendencies, and that I'll kind of, so which tendency are you?
I'm an upholder.
You're an upholder. Yeah, so am I.
Well, you know, it's interesting because many people who do this kind of work are upholders, but we're actually not very good representatives because we're an extreme and kind of fringe small group. Most people aren't like us. And it was I basically had to rewrite my whole better than before when I realized that I was an upholder, because I realized that a lot of the things that I assumed would work for people because they worked so well for me.
Right.
Well, no, they're not going to, because to be an upholder is to be very different from other people. And absolutely. I'm sure you feel that way yourself. Like, most people can't do it the way you can do it. And I think a lot of times we don't understand why that is. Like, we think, oh, well, you know, I get up early and work out. And if you got up early and worked out, that would work for you. It's like, possibly.
That was, so I used to be a high school teacher. I was a teacher for 12 years. And that was one of the things about my personality, I think, that made me a terrible teacher. Is that when I was growing up, school was just easy to me.
Yeah.
Right. And so I was constantly frustrated about why I couldn't get my students to be motivated and, you know, like, why didn't they just memorize things? Like, that's just what you do. So when I read Better Than Before and I took the quiz and I was like, oh, well, duh, that's why. So it really helped.
No, I mean, and it's interesting that you say that, because I think one of the very striking things about upholders is they are very frustrated by other people. And I feel like I have a lot more forbearance for people now that I understand they're not like me, because I was just like, you know, I'd say to an Elijah friend, like, you keep saying this is important to you. You keep talking about it and then you do nothing. Like, I don't understand what's going on here. And it was hard for me to be sympathetic, because to an upholder, that's like, kind of like, why would this be happening? But if I understood, like, from she's an obliger, then it would be very much, I would feel a lot, now I feel a lot more sympathy for that person. And I feel like I can be much more constructive with my suggestions if she asks for suggestions. I try not to be too much of a habits bully if I can help it. because you're right. I mean, that it's something that many upholders have said, is that we get very kind of impatient with other people because it's hard for us to remember that we're not like people of the other tendencies.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a really great insight when I read that, to kind of have peace with myself almost. And then to be able to look at other people and say, okay, now I understand why you are the way that you are. Yeah. And we're not all built similarly when it comes to that sort of habit change. So kind of and changing topics a little bit here, did you ever expect your life would kind of take the turn that it did? And I know you purposely made a choice to leave the job that you were doing and try something new and take that risk. But do you ever wake up nowadays and think, wow, what have I done here? This is pretty cool. You know, do you ever have those moments, or are you just kind of in the mix and going about your daily life and, you know, picking up after your kids and that sort of thing? Do you ever have those moments and you're like, wow, I did all this?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I should be better about stepping back. I mean, my happiness project was all about this, like, you know, really mindfully stepping back and kind of looking at the big picture. And with my work, I'm usually so focused on what I'm working on now and kind of obsessively interested in a subject that it's hard for me to kind of think about, oh, you know, I've got this whole all these things going on, or like, here's the whole mass, because I'm so focused on that. And one thing I don't do, and I really should do, and I should have done it my whole life, and I see over and over that I don't, which is I never say, like, well, where do I want to be in 3 years, and where do I want to be in 5 years? I feel like that's so unknowable that I don't even want to think about it. But I know that it would be, even if it didn't happen, it's useful for planning purposes. And it's good to have a sense, you know, you're not going to hit a target by not aiming at it. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I find that very hard to do, to kind of have these overview thoughts about what I'm doing. I love thinking about what I am doing, but I don't often step back like that.
Yeah. Do you have a big question that you're curious about now? Anything geeky that you're kind of going off on a tangent about? You're like, you're going to be delving into, or are you just kind of riding the wave?
Well, in Better Than Before, I wrote about these four tendencies. Yeah. And anybody who's curious, on my site, GretchenRubin.com, you can take the quiz if you want to know if you're a questioner, if you're an upholder, a questioner, an obliger, or a rebel.
Yep.
You and I are upholders. My friend who was on the track team but can't go running now, she's an obliger. Uh-huh. But ever since Better Than Before came out, I've been deluged with people who want more information. They're like, I'm the parent of a rebel child and I don't know what to do. Or I am the manager of a team of four questioners and they're driving me crazy. How do I fix it? Somebody said, I want to hire only obligers. How do I screen in the hiring process?
Wow.
Things like that. And there was so much that I couldn't put in the book because it just didn't fit. You know, it was one strategy of 21 strategies that we can use to change our habits. So I couldn't let it swamp the whole book, but it was a much bigger idea. And it really transcends habit. It has to do with all of your nature, not just your habit formation.
Yeah.
And so I'm working on that. And it's been interesting because I have a podcast that I just started with my sister called Happier with Gretchen Rubin. And we spent 4 weeks on the four tendencies, each week focusing on a different tendency. And again, so much response from listeners about their own experience and the people around them that I'm just like, it's just like gold to me.
Yeah.
You know, all this evidence, all these examples, all these insights. And so I am working on a book which is only the four tendencies. So, but in a way, it's funny because it was sort of summarized before it existed in full form in Better Than Before. But now I'm going to let it be its own book because it was too squashed in Better Than Before. So I'm working on that now obsessively. And that's funny. This is an interesting question that a problem that I often face in this. It's like sometimes like there's not a subject you can look up in a card catalog. Like you can't, like you could look up happiness, but I can't look up the four tendencies because I made it up, you know? So how do I find my sources?
Right.
I have to just be like, well, medical adherence. What do those people say? Or, oh, you know, Andre Agassi, he seems like he might have something going on with his tendency. Let me read his memoir or whatever. It's hard to look things up because I'm making up the subject. So it's a fun challenge in terms of pushing, and which is why hearing from listeners and readers is so helpful because that's really my best source, is their personal experiences.
Yeah, a true detective, really, trying to gather all these loose ends and tie them together into something so succinct. Yeah. So speaking of reader questions, as I mentioned earlier, I had the chance yesterday to pose this on my social media, which is if you could ask a happiness expert anything you wanted, what would you ask? And I had so many questions from, similar, like, I'm a rebel, like, how do I deal with such and such in my everyday life? And all sorts of really good, like every question I read, I was like, wow, that's amazing. But I've got a couple that I selected. And if you're game, I'll ask you and see what you think.
Yeah.
Okay. So Jerry asks, how do you help others see, especially those closest to you, that happiness is a choice?
Well, that is very interesting. It's funny that he uses that language because I have to say that language does not resonate with me. Many people say that, so clearly it resonates very deeply.
Right.
I don't really get that. I get that you can choose to do the things that will tend to make you happier. But I'm not sure you can just choose. But people clearly can because they say that with such authentic enthusiasm.
Right.
But I think if what his larger question is like, how can you help the people around you be happy?
Yeah.
Well, one thing that's worth thinking about is that about 50% of happiness is genetically determined. So some people are born tiggers and some people are born ears, and that's kind of hardwired. Then 10 to 20% is life circumstances. So that's things like age, health, income, occupation, marital status, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then all the rest is very much a product of the way that we think and the way that we act. And so that's where happiness can come in. And I guess that's where the choice comes in. That's the part that you're sort of choosing.
Right.
And what I found is that sometimes people who are on the happier side want to make the people who are on the less happy side happier. Partly they want to do it for that person's own benefit, and partly they want to do it because of something called emotional contagion, which is that we pick up emotions from each other. So if you work right next to somebody who's constantly slightly melancholic, that's going to rub off on you. And I think a lot of times people want to fix that. But here's the thing. People don't like to be fixed. And there, a lot of the tiggers, call them the tiggers and the Eeyores, the tiggers march around and say things like, look on the bright side, cheer up, it won't hurt you to smile, you know. And the Eeyores are like, you're not being realistic, you're not hearing my point of view, I don't like you keep, you're just being very intrusive. And from what I've observed is that it's very true that happy people tend to make people happier. You lift people up with your happy spirits. You can do things that will help other people to be happy. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But the, if you really get in there and try to mess with somebody else's happiness state, you can end up really antagonizing them, and you can both sort of become polarized and really drain each other.
Right.
And so if there's somebody that you wish would choose to make happiness a choice, maybe what you want to do is just to try to let your happiness lift them up and try to be constructive, but also to respect their point of view. And maybe, and like if people seem like they're too pessimistic, you could, if when people feel understood, then a lot of times they can let go of like their negative emotions. So for instance, if you said, you know, you keep saying that you don't think our team is going to be able to finish this report by the end of the month, and you're very concerned about that. Now, I think we can do it. But I hear that you're concerned, and that's a valid concern. Mm. And then a person doesn't feel like they have to keep bringing it up. But if you're like, oh, come on, don't look at that way. It's going to be great. You know, and then you're like, you're not paying attention to what I'm saying. I'm saying, I don't think we can make it. You know, and then the person, and then it's like they feel like they have to keep bringing it up and insisting to be heard. You know, if people feel heard, then it's like, you can have your view and I'm going to have my view, and I can't, and we're just coming, we're just different. But I know that feeling, like we want the people around us to be happy, and sort of the happier we are, the more we want others to be happy, which is often a good thing. But but if you talk to those people who are the Eeyores, they often do not find it to be constructive.
Right.
They often really kind of feel like they're not being allowed to be who they are or to express their own opinions, and they resent that.
Yeah, gets their dander up.
Yeah, and then that just makes everything worse.
Are you a tigger or an Eeyore?
I'm medium. I'm a medium tigger. On the 1 to 10 scale of happiness, I'm a 7. So I'm sort of neither one thing or the other. But I mean, I definitely have many people in my life who are, you know, on the 10 scale, they're 9s, and they're on an average day, and on an average day, they're 5s.
Yeah.
You know, and like, you can't make the a person who's an average 5 into an average 9. Sure. What you can do is you can affect people's range. I mean, I think we all have a range. So maybe my range is 6 to 9, and somebody else's range is 4 to 7. Mm-hmm. We can both try to do things to push ourselves up to the high point of our natural range. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, a lot of times you see this with parents and children. If you have like a very happy parent who's like an 8, 9, and they have a child who's like, call it a 5, 6, they want that child to be more bouncy and bubbly and exuberant and friendly and outgoing and fun and happy. And, you know, you kind of, you get what you get, and you don't get upset this, you know, with people's natures. I mean, you can try to get them up to the top of their range, but there's not, There people do have different natures.
For sure. Awesome. So another question, Carol asks, how can you find peace and happiness with what you have in the present while still trying to be your best self in the future?
Oh my goodness. That is a
million-dollar question. Yeah,
that is a big conflict.
Yeah.
And I think that when people are like, oh, just think about the moment, now is the only time that matters, that is not a recipe for a good life. There are many times where it is appropriate for us to impose burdens on ourselves or to deny ourselves things in the present because we anticipate that there's going to be a reason in the future that we're going to be glad that we did it. Now, as research shows, we're often not very good at being able to predict what will make us happy. So you want to spend a lot of time examining your assumptions, you know, like, oh, if I get this giant fish tattoo on my arm today, how's it going to make me feel in 5 years? You know, we're not so good. We're not that good sometimes. But there are things where, like, if I quit smoking today, will I likely be happier for it in 5 years? And I think most people would say, even if they don't want to quit smoking, they would say, if I did quit smoking in 5 years, I would be happy that I had done it. You know, but there's always this trade-off, and like, when and where is it? And I think each of us just has to decide for ourselves, when is the appropriate time to sacrifice or to constrain in the present in order to have a future payoff. Now, I will say this, that in Better Than Before, one of the strategies that I talk about is the strategy of loophole spotting. Mm. And a loophole is when we say that we're committed to a good habit, but we come up with a loophole, which, oh yeah, I'm totally committed to eating healthfully, but just this once I see that I'm off the hook because it's my birthday, you baked this for me, or whatever it is. And I love studying loopholes. They're hilarious. We're all such ingenious advocates for ourselves. There's 10 categories of loopholes. But here's how it comes up with this idea of the present and the future. There's what I call the fake self-actualization loophole. And this is a loophole that comes in the guise of life, embracing life. Right. And so somebody says, life's too short not to eat a brownie. You know, I want to live a little. Right. You know, it's such a beautiful day. How could I possibly go to the gym? How could I possibly like work out in a gym? And I don't have my running shoes, so I should just sit on this bench or whatever. Now, sometimes that's true, but sometimes it's a loophole, you know? And I think, again, you have to really be honest with yourself. Like, how are you going to feel about this later? You know, you say, like, life's too short not to eat a brownie. How are you going to feel about that brownie tonight? Are you going to be like, oh, I'm so glad I embraced life and had a brownie? Or are you going to be like, man, I really wish I had stuck to my good habits, you know? And one thing to do is to anticipate, to make these decisions early. Like if you're like, well, it's my anniversary, I want to go to this wonderful restaurant and have the best dessert on the menu, I look forward to it and I'm going to do it. That's great. That's a wonderful way. Let your, you know, to do that. Sure. But if you're just deciding in the moment and letting yourself off the hook, a lot of times people regret that. And so you want to be very careful when you feel this embrace now, embrace life, ideas start floating through your head because it often is sort of a temporary cover. That in the long run doesn't get you where you want to go.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny. I used to have I still know her, a gal that lives here in San Diego, and she is one of the first people that I ever really talked to about mindset. I was trying to become, a more mentally strong athlete. And one of the things that she had me do, which I had never really done before, was sit down and write down all the things that could go wrong in this competition that I was going to do. And then talk about and write about how I would react to that. For example, I'm jump roping and my jump rope breaks. You know, there's certain things that are going to happen that are not under your control. And so I thought it was a really helpful exercise to almost, and this seems a little bit like what you're, maybe it's not, in my case, it wasn't a habit that I was trying to change, but just almost that future priming the pump of like, how are you going to respond to something like this if it does happen? Because we know that sometimes bad things happen and things out of our control happen. And so to me, that was a really useful exercise that I had never done before, which is almost putting myself in that potential. Well, what if that happened? What would I do?
Right.
And
in
it
my
was,
frame,
it's great.
In my framework, I call that the strategy of safeguards, which is to anticipate failure and to anticipate challenge and to think like, okay, what would I do? You know, both in sort of like, okay, well, I'm going to go to the holiday party. How am I going to behave? What am I going to do? Or, okay, like, if I do slip up, like, how am I going to get myself back in the saddle? Because sometimes people feel like it's fatalistic to imagine themselves failing or like something bad happening. But just as your example shows, there's sort of, it can be reassuring to take yourself through that and to imagine, to say like, well, I have things that I could do. I would be able to move forward in one way or another. Yeah. And then if it does happen, then you're enormously benefited because you thought of it, you know, sure. Which is before you might not have. So that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
Safeguards.
So I can't believe 35 minutes has almost passed and I want to honor your time. So I'm going to ask you now one of the questions that I ask all of my guests, which has to do with being unbreakable and this concept of being resilient. And so I'm going to ask you now, what do you think is the most important ingredient in building an unbreakable human?
You know, I really think that it's self-knowledge. We can build a happy, healthy, productive life only on the foundation of our own nature, our own values. You were talking about values earlier, our own interests. I think the more that we know ourselves and we build a life that reflects our true nature, our true interests, our true values, I think that's when we become our happiest, our healthiest, our most productive. I think it's when we become the most resilient, when we face a challenge. And it's so easy to kind of get swept up with like your fantasies of who you think you should be or who other people want you to be or who you wish you were. And but I find that the more that I focus on like, who am I and how am I like other people and how am I different from other people? Because a lot of times it's not that there's a right way and a wrong way. It's just that we each have to figure out what works for us. And if we're working together, we need to figure out a way so that we can both thrive. But it's very hard to do that if without self-knowledge. So for me, that's the key step is to know yourself, which is the most ancient advice. By the way, it was on the Temple of Apollo at Delphi.
Right.
So I did not make this up, but it's too important, you know, to be new.
Yeah. And like you said in the Happiness Project is be Gretchen, right?
Yes.
Be yourself.
Yeah. Substitute your own name.
Yeah. Exactly. Thanks for that. So one of the last things that I do, and I never tell anybody that I'm going to do this. It's a little surprise. Ooh. It's called the Gauntlet. And it's a few rapid fire questions that I just toss out. They're super easy. And you just say whatever comes to your mind. And sometimes I never know what's going to happen, but there's always a laugh or two in there. So,
okay.
Are you ready?
Yep.
Okay. Every morning I start my day with?
Getting my dog up. My new puppy.
Oh, awesome. Going to have to look that up for sure. Favorite veggie?
Tied between broccoli and cauliflower. I don't know. Maybe cauliflower.
Cauliflower. I think you may be the first person that's ever said that. So,
what did people say?
Gosh, I don't know. There's a whole a lot of people say kale. I guess that's like the du jour veggie. I remember when it was like a garnish on plates. Like no one ate kale. What would be your ideal lazy day?
You just cut out on me for a second.
Oh, what would be one thing you would do on your ideal lazy day?
Oh, read in bed.
Not a surprise there from someone who's an author and does a lot of research. The habit you're most proud of yourself for creating for yourself.
Ooh, that's a tie between blogging most days of the week and going low carb. I eat very low carb.
Awesome.
So both of those are habits that I like.
I have to say your blog is fantastic.
Thank you. That's so nice to hear.
And I know a lot of other people appreciate the time that you put into that. It's really good reading. If it were the zombie apocalypse, which weapon would you yield?
I don't even know what the choices are.
You can just pick one.
I would pick a machete.
Awesome. Very close. That's a close combat thing. We're going to get right into it.
I don't know what zombies are susceptible to. So.
I think pretty much anything. You just have to make sure you hit them hard enough.
Yeah. Okay.
And the last question, the advice you would have given yourself at 20 years old.
To be Gretchen for exactly the reasons I say. I mean, I went to law school, you know, like I said, for the wrong reasons. It ended up great, but I didn't do it for the right reasons. And yeah, to be Gretchen would be my advice.
Amazing. Well, you survived the gauntlet.
Yeah.
Congratulations. I keep meaning to make stickers or something and send them to people so they can like put them on their mugs or something and say, I survived the gauntlet. So before we wrap it up, let's just maybe give people a quick idea of where they can most easily connect with you on social media.
Excellent. Great. Yeah. We were talking about my blog, which is GretchenRubin.com. And I write there just about every day about my adventures and happiness and good habits. And there's a lot of resources there, like discussion guides and starter kits and one pagers about how to change your habits and stuff. And then also I have my new podcast, which is Happier with Gretchen Rubin. Yeah, we've just hit 4 million downloads,
which is
recently.
Amazing.
Yeah, no, we were so excited.
That's incredible.
In just several months. Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah.
And I do that with my sister, who's like hilariously funny and brilliant. And that's just anywhere you listen to your podcast.
Sure.
And then my name is my handle. So on Facebook, Gretchen Rubin, I have a lot of stuff going on my page. Mm-hmm. Twitter is Gretchen Rubin. Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, whatever your social media of choice is. Yeah.
That's amazing. So, and you've got, I mean, if people haven't been to your site or your social media, your podcast, you really are the type of person that is just like, guys, here's everything I know and I'm going to put it together for you and please run with it and give me feedback. And you're so open, to that sort of stuff. And it's just such a great treasure trove, I think, for people who are trying to dig into this stuff themselves. So I wanted to thank you personally and then on behalf of people everywhere, because I know people that chimed in on social media yesterday were like, oh my gosh, it's just, it's helped me so much. And
so nice to hear. I appreciate that so much.
Yeah. So Gretchen Rubin, GretchenRubin.com and all the happiness books, go find them, go listen to the podcast. And it's been a really, really big pleasure talking with you. And I so appreciate all of your time.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy to have talked to you.
All right. Take care. Bye. Thank you again so much for tuning in to Harder to Kill Radio. Go snag the show notes at stupideasypaleo.com/29 to get links to everything Gretchen and I talked about. And the link there to take her quiz is in the show notes as well. If you're loving Harder to Kill Radio, I have one special request, and that's to share the show with someone important in your life, a friend, a loved one, someone you think would benefit from hearing from all of my amazing guests. Your endorsement means so much to the people that you love and care about, and I'd be so grateful if you would just pass on the word. If you'd like to review the show and hit subscribe yourself on iTunes, to get there the easiest, head to stupideasypaleo.com/review. And since this show is airing the week of American Thanksgiving, I would like to wish all of you a very healthy, happy, and safe holiday with those that you love. Make sure to join me next week for an interview with a self-quantification expert and fellow podcaster that will really help you up your wellness game. Super interesting show. Okay, until next time, stay healthy, happy, and you know the rest. Harder to kill.